You're Mr. Carlberg,
yes.
Right? I think you're up since you're the appellant, right?
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Ken Carlberg. I'm counsel for Stanley Smith, the appellant in this action. Mr. Smith seeks the reversal of the trial court.
Any rebuttal time?
Oh, please, 2 minutes.
If two? You would. Okay. Yes.
Mr. Smith seeks the reversal of the trial court's determination that certain formal demands in telephone calls, letters, and in the form of a filed complaint, all of which were issued to M&M Technologies by the SEC, rise to the level of a claim under two warranty provisions that were in the contracts at issue. The trial court determined that the SEC claim against M&M was an inchoate claim and therefore weren't breached of those two warranty provisions. We believe this was an error of law. Is to be reviewed de novo by this court. We ask that the court reverse and enter judgment in Mr. Smith's favor, including pre- and post-judgment interest. The two warranty provisions at issue are essentially the same ones in a...
Counsel, perhaps it would be helpful if you answered the questions that we posed. We communicated certain questions that we wanted counsel to ask.
Which one would you want me to address, Your Honor?
Well, let me back up then. Did you get the questions that
no,
were communicated?
No,
okay.
But I'll address those directly.
Okay. The questions that were, Mr. Shepherd, did you get the questions?
I did, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry.
There were questions communicated by the case manager to, were supposed to have been communicated. The first question is, what effect does the Miller case, Miller versus Commercial Union Assurance Company case that you cited in your brief on appeal, have on this case? That's the first question. The second question is what the effect of Trial Exhibit 38, that's the amended complaint dated April 9th, 2007, have on this case.
Okay.
That would help us to come to grips with this case.
Your Honor, the Miller case, from Mr. Smith's perspective, stands for the proposition that if the two warranty clauses were breached, then those two agreements are null and void. And therefore he's put back, should be put back in his original position, which is the return of the $600,000. And in specifically, the Miller case provides that unlike representations, warranties are given a special treatment at law, in which case they are put in by the party specifically so that there's certainty as to if that condition or that set of facts exists or doesn't exist, they have certainty. There's no proof of materiality. There's no room for any wiggle room. In this instance, if this court determines that the SEC exchanges with Mr. Martin constitute a claim and rise to that level, then that we take the position that the two warranty provisions have been breached and though they're null and void and he's entitled to the return of the funds.
Let me ask you a follow-up question. Does the efficacy of those warranties, is that affected by the knowledge by the person making the warrant that the warranted fact is true?
That's an interesting question, and that is, I think, probably the most interesting question in this case. Our position is, Your Honor, that even though the court found, on a more likely than not basis, that the information relating to the SEC claim was disclosed, that determination was made on a more likely than not basis. From Mr. Smith's standpoint, the judge got it wrong. This is a travesty, and he's up here trying to right a wrong through the legal lens that this court is limited to viewing it from. And in this instance, our position is when you have a warranty and you're entitled to the certainty of that warranty if it's breached, it ought not to matter whether you know or not, unless there's a waiver. And the waiver's not been raised. It wasn't raised at trial court. It wasn't raised here. It wasn't raised. And, of course, it takes a knowing and intelligent waiver for that to occur. In this instance, his knowledge shouldn't matter because, one, his knowledge hasn't been determined with absolute certainty. If the court got it wrong, then that warranty still should give him the certainty that he bargained for. That's how that contract should be read. Now, if I can turn now to the amended complaint. The amended complaint was kind of the last piece of the puzzle before Mr. Smith signed on April 11th, 2007. Up until that point, the court has the exchanges of the letters and the testimony. On April 9th, 2 days before it was signed, that amended complaint was filed.
How do we know it was filed? The exhibit does not show that it was filed.
Well, it certainly shows, and for instance, that's true, Your Honor. If you look at the signature page, it's signed by the U.S. government on behalf of the SEC on April 9th on the last page. It doesn't, obviously, it was not served on M&M until sometime later. Our position is that the warranty language in the two provisions doesn't even require that M&M know. It is not a subjective or objective standard that those two warranties.
Well, my question is focused on whether or not there's any evidence in the record that the complaint was filed as of April 9th.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, not specifically.
But I take it it's your position, your apparent position from the arguments made below, is that a claim existed as of April 9th.
A claim existed before then, Your Honor.
At no later than April 9th.
Correct.
And that the knowledge of the warranting party is irrelevant to whether or not that warranty is ineffective.
In the circumstances of this case, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think in this instance, what's a key part of whether a claim existed or not isn't just the complaint that was filed, isn't just the letter exchanges that make clear that the government is pressing for $550,000 to be returned. If the court recall, Mr. Martin actually did an internal investigation himself to check his own bank records to see if those funds had been received by M&M, and he was well aware that they had been. So he had the SEC demanding them back. He had his own internal proof knowing that he had the funds. And then he had the indication from the SEC that they want them back, and they got around to drafting and signing a complaint dated April 9th. Then later, of course, it determined that they settled and $600,000+ had to be paid plus whatever. And so if you put all those together, we believe that falls within the ordinary meaning of the claim, which is a demand for compensation. And we have a circumstance here where M&M drafted or at least used their forms. The term claim is not a defined term, so if it's ambiguous, it should be construed against the drafter, in this case M&M. And in this course, we think the court made an error of law in the application of undisputed facts to what the phrase or the term claim means.
As I read your appellate brief, the sole issue that you raise on appeal, notwithstanding what was fought over at the trial court, is the breach of warranty claim.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I think the balance of the issues we had with are matters for the trial court to determine of the integrity of and credibility of the witnesses.
Okay. Thank you. You have your rebuttal time. Excuse me.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Douglas Shepard. I represent Mr. Martin and M&M Technologies. As I understood, the three questions was whether Miller was argued at the lower court. It wasn't. This issue of breach of warranty was not really litigated. If you look at the trial briefs and stuff, they really called it a misrepresentation from day one. The second question is, what is the effect of
Miller? Let me back up here. Was Miller cited, not argued?
No.
Breach of warranty was argued, was it not?
No. It was argued as a misrepresentation. I will explain to the court. I actually, when you talk about it being a warranty, and we talk about Exhibit 36, so why don't we go to Exhibit 36 at this time. When Exhibit 38 was offered, I objected because it was hearsay, and that's a reported proceedings 259, and said that it was an incomplete document, and just because the lawyer signed it doesn't mean it was ever filed or served. We don't know when it was filed or served. The fact is, I looked at the records. It doesn't look like the complaint was ever, in fact, filed. And I told the court then the court admitted it just for the limited purposes of demonstrating that Mr. Martin had notice of a claim in May of 2007. And that's found at page 261 of the report of proceedings. So then I offered.
Well, what would be hearsay about it?
It's an out-of-court document offered for the truth of the matter asserted that there's been a claim.
Well, no, it's not. It's offered. The document contains assertions about wrongdoing. Those assertions, the truth of those assertions, are not what that the purpose of admitting it was. The fact that the assertions were made was the purpose of admitting it. And that's not the truth of the assertions in the document.
Well, it's
the existence of the document that makes assertions, not the assertions themselves. The assertions themselves would clearly be hearsay, but not the fact that the assertions were made.
But what date the assertions were filed in the court was an issue, because we were arguing that claim meant that there had to be a litigation. And in fact, in their response, they broke out the difference between the complaint as a claim and investigation, which occurred previous to that time. So we put in exhibit.
Well, but if the U.S. attorney, whoever this is, if he's signed his name under Federal Rule 11 to a document, it's no longer just an investigation, right? I mean, he's concluded the investigation.
I believe he hasn't concluded the investigation until he files the amended complaint. It's just a document in his office. It's no different than a letter until the document is filed.
Well, notwithstanding your objection, the exhibit, as I read the record, was admitted. Was it not?
For the limited purposes of demonstrating, and that's found at page 261 of verbatim, for the limited purposes of demonstrating that in May of 2007 we had notice of the claim.
Okay.
So I put in the summons in the complaint when the summons was actually issued by the, this is the only document we actually have, was in April 24th of 2007. That's exhibit number 27. I'm assuming there was a complaint attached to it, although we couldn't find it in the file. And that came in at the time we came in. It was objected to on its relevancy. I wondered if they were going to go forward on a warranty claim, how they were going to establish when, in fact, the complaint had been filed and served, because there was an examination as to when my client was served. There was no evidence offered.
Well, let me just cut to the chase here. The whole purpose of this line of inquiry is to determine when there was notice of the amended complaint, right?
No, I was trying to determine when the complaint had actually been filed.
Okay.
I think probably the claim exists when it's been filed.
And why is it necessary for the party claiming breach of warranty to establish when the claim was filed? The warranty doesn't say anything about claim being filed. It says the existence of a claim.
Because I believe it doesn't. According to the context of the party's negotiation, a claim doesn't exist until the complaint is filed and perhaps served.
And why is context important here? You read the warranty, it says a claim. It doesn't say a file claim.
It's not defined. And in Black's law, it's a legal assertion, a legal demand. In the sixth edition, it's a cause of action. It's undisputed that all the parties were well aware of the SEC investigation before they signed the agreement. There's no reason to put in a clause that would put anybody in violation of the agreement in the context of what was occurring. And then what happened is, if it just said claim, if the agreement just said there is no claims, it would be a warranty. I was concerned about this issue. That's why I put it in. That's why I said it was relevant. But it says more. It says, is not presently a subject of any claim that would have a material adverse effect on the other party. And I think that's why Mr. Smith went to trial arguing misrepresentation. The document calls the SEC investigation, which we were well aware of, and the filing of its claim had a material adverse effect. So then they went on to talk about how all of this was a representation that there was, one, no claim, and two, if there was a claim, it would not have a material adverse effect upon Mr. Smith. So if it was just the first part of the sentence, it would be a warranty. We tried this case as though it was a representation. I was concerned about this issue, and that's why I put in exhibit number 26, and that's why I was arguing, in fact, there was no claim. That's why the judge, based upon 26 said that there was no claim. In the context, he believed it meant a lawsuit because he believed there had been full representation. In fact, there's findings that haven't been appealed that indicated we gave full information to Mr. Smith about the SEC investigation and the status of it all the way up to April 11th, and that a claim had not been filed based upon the party's interpretation of the claim in the context of the litigation. And I do think we have to talk about it. It doesn't make sense when there's a finding and when there's an admission that there's been full disclosure of the status of the SEC matter, that that was intended by them to be covered as a potential claim. I don't know if I've answered the course. And then when we look at what the effect, the interesting
Mr.
thing.
Mr. Shepard, in your answer, though, you indicate, well, I won't try and categorize what you indicate. I'll categorize what Judge Snyder indicated. Now, I would further find that a requirement to pay $550,000 to the SEC by M&M would have been within the purview of paragraph 12.1G of the licensing agreement and paragraph 5 of the R&D agreement. If such a claim existed, it would be a material claim that might have a material adverse effect upon the other party, but it didn't exist at that time. So Judge Snyder didn't say that it wasn't a claim outside the documents. He said that it didn't exist.
Because he was finding it needed to be filed as a lawsuit.
I understand.
In the context
of... So we are again down to whether or not a claim exists, not whether this claim would fall within the purview of the documents, because Judge Snyder ruled that it would if it existed.
I apologize. A complaint in this form filed would be a claim. I'm not arguing that. Whether the claim would exist at the time that the subpoena was issued and the complaint was actually filed, I don't know between the two of them. I don't know when the complaint was filed. I will represent you, and it's not in the record, and it was Mr. Smith's burden that there was an order allowing an amended complaint to be filed on April 16th of 2000.
Your argument seems to be that what the agreement, what the warranty means, is a filed claim.
Absolutely. It could not
have... Notwithstanding the fact that filed is not in the language.
I believe a complaint that's not filed or served is not a claim.
Do you believe that someone in the state of Washington who suffers personal injury from a municipality and is about to bring a lawsuit, but because of the notice of claim statute has to file some paperwork before filing the lawsuit, doesn't have a claim before the lawsuit is filed? Do you understand my...
They haven't made a claim before the lawsuit is filed. They may have to have one, two, or three steps they have to do before they can bring the claim, but the claim is brought when they file a lawsuit in that context.
So a demand letter. Let's say the SEC had just sent a demand letter to Mr. Martin. We're going to file this against you, but if you want to just settle it, pay me $200,000. That's not a claim.
As in the context of this case, it's not a claim. That's correct. And the interesting thing is, again, there was no request for rescission. There's no demonstration of any damages for that breach of warranty. There's no compliance with the other provisions that you have to give. If you believe it's a material breach, you have to give 30 days written notice to Mr. Martin and M&M's that there's been a material breach. There's none of that which would allow them a remedy. And the remedy they asked for was damages, and they didn't prove any damages.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I think we've got our hands around it. We take a contrary position that a claim can be a claim without being a lawsuit. Your Honor, you pointed out that as soon as the Attorney General signs the complaint, it's obviously he's concluding his investigation and he's going to file it. We believe that it was a claim even before it got to the point where an amended complaint was drafted, signed, and prepared.
There's a contention that you didn't argue breach of warranty below, but in the final argument, I see the words breach of warranty and some discussion about that.
Your Honor, it was fully argued. It really was. We take issue with that representation.
Did you cite Miller?
No, Miller wasn't cited at that time. It was, the argument was made clearly. Otherwise, Judge Snyder wouldn't have specifically ruled on whether it was a claim or not, and whether it was within the context of the two. So it was squarely before him, and that's how he resolved it. And I want to clarify for the record that it is not undisputed, and it never was admitted by Mr. Smith, that he had full knowledge of this SEC claim ahead of time. That is how, on a more likely not basis, the court resolved all the testimony. He disputed it. And so what he's entitled to, we assert, is the protection that a warranty should provide, the certainty that he should get from that, not just of whether it's true or not, but in this instance, the protection if the court got it wrong. If the court got it wrong that it was fully disclosed, that warranty still should protect him. That's the certainty he bargained for. And we ask this court to reverse, and since it was undisputed that he gave $600,000 pursuant to these agreements, the money should be returned and he should be entitled to pre- and post-judgment interest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our calendar.